to resist being last on your list, but no other man's gonna do. So I'm saving.
Of course, that's the unmistakable voice of Whitney Houston, Saving All My Love. We're about to talk to Masha Gessen, Russian-American journalist. Her most recent book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of the Pussy Riot. And Masha Gessen, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And later, you all know that you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. I was reading a lot about your just personal story of growing up in the Soviet Union, your family coming to America, and your decision to go back to Russia. To live in that society and helping try to build a new Russia. And that sojourn has taken a lot of twisted turns for you. Fill that in for us. Why? You know, I know your family fled the anti-Semitism of the Soviet Union, but then you went back.
Right. Well, it wasn't my decision to leave.
Right, you were a kid.
Teenager, so I felt like I was taken out of the country against my will. And actually, I had become a journalist. I went back to Russia for the first time on a story in 1991, before the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I discovered that not only was it the most exciting and interesting story in the world, it was also home, which is something I didn't expect to feel having left as a teenager. And I got really mad, and I thought, I'm not going to let some stupid thing like anti-Semitism keep me out of my home. And coincidentally, the state-enforced anti-Semitism basically ceased. So I started doing a lot of stories in Russia, and eventually I drifted back. So by the end of 93, I was living there full time.
And I mean, and so you left again. You left Russia because of the persecution of lesbian and gays and other people, and you had kids. There was a big threat about that, which we'll talk about. But so I'm curious the changes you've seen, especially in terms of kind of the anti-gay and lesbian and transgender views of the Russian government and of the Russian society. How did you see the change from the moment you got back in 93 to now? What was that arc?
Well, that's a long that's a long time in any country's history. Certainly, a lot of things changed in this country over that.
No question. Right.
But what happened in Russia is, you know, things liberalized. I think they didn't liberalize quite as fast as I thought they would on the LGBT issues. But certainly people became more comfortable. For about a decade, I was the only public person in Russia who was out, and then I wasn't all of a sudden. And that was a relief. But the thing is that by the time the clock was turned back about 2 years ago, a lot of people in Russia had created some sort of existence for themselves that was comfortable. That they may not be publicly out, but they were out to their neighbors, or if they had kids, they were out to the teachers, the pediatrician. That's what makes what has happened in Russia so insidious and so unusual. You know, we haven't really seen this in a long, long time. We haven't seen a country that was going in one direction suddenly reverse directions and leave so many people exposed. I mean, they don't have a closet to go back into.
So the law that was passed and was debated that happened around Russia that really codified it almost being illegal to be gay or lesbian in Russia. You can talk a bit about that. And you created the Pink Triangle campaign, which had more of an effect and support than you realized when you began it.
Well, yes and no. I think it felt like it got a lot of support. Yeah, basically, when I realized that that the anti-gay campaign was becoming a federal thing, a national thing, and I think I realized it much later than a lot of people did. I certainly realized it later than Pussy Riot realized that it was becoming a major issue in Russian politics. I went on television. I recorded a video showing pictures of my family and explaining that this proposed law on so-called homosexual propaganda would actually make it illegal for me to tell my kids that we were just as good as anybody else. And I said that it was fascism. It enshrined second-class citizenship. And I asked people who didn't want to see fascism in Russia to put on a pink triangle as a sign of solidarity with the LGBT citizens of the country. And it was very inspiring because I had about 6,000 pink triangle buttons printed up, and I handed most of them out very, very quickly. But then 6,000 in a country of 140 million is not a very large number.
No, it's not. I understand that completely. I mean, but one of the things in part of this bill was that there was a real serious threat that the children of gay and lesbian couples could be taken from them.
Right. And there are a couple of things. First of all, there are several bills. In addition to the propaganda bill, there's a bill on protecting children from harmful information. There's a ban on same-sex adoption. And there's pending legislation. It hasn't been passed yet. There's pending legislation that would remove children from same-sex households, period. But in addition to the legislation, which, as I said, is a small part of it, there's this concerted campaign of hate. And that's already affected a lot of families. It's already caused social services to go after families, in spite of the fact that the legislation hasn't even passed yet. So there's basically open season on gays and lesbians in Russia, especially on gays and lesbians with children.
So what do you think has caused this virulent response? I mean, it was always difficult, but what caused this virulent response, do you think, in Russia?
What caused this campaign?
Yeah. I mean, what was underlying it? What pushed it at this time?
Well, first of all, it's always handy to have a minority that you can beat up on and scapegoat. So that's sort of a given.
Mm-hmm.
Why this particular minority? I think it actually reflects Putin's view of the world. I think he thinks that the protest movement, which he was faced with a couple of years ago, is inspired by the West. And nobody represents the West better than gay and lesbian people. It's sort of, you know, we're the quintessential foreign agent, and foreign agent has become a catchphrase in Russia to indicate anybody whom Putin perceives as an enemy of the state. But once they started the sort of typical scapegoating campaign, they realized that it could be more than that. It can be Russia's new ideology. It can be its new identity on the international stage. So now Russia has aspirations of becoming the traditional values capital of the world. And what that means for LGBT people in Russia is that this campaign will continue to intensify and things will continue to get worse.
So you've lived in both countries. You're back here in the United States, obviously, to save your family and to keep your children with you. You know, and we've seen in the United States over the years in localized efforts to do similar things of taking children away from gay and lesbian couples, not nationally in some massive movement, but we've seen it happen in localized situations at least 10 years ago and a little bit more. But I'm curious what you see as a fundamental difference, A, between both societies and the cultures of both societies when it comes to the lives of gay and lesbian people and the acceptance or non-acceptance. I mean, you can say there's acceptance in America, but there's a huge amount of the world that doesn't accept it in America. So how do you analyze the between the two nations?
I'm not even sure that the comparison can be made, to be honest.
Why is that?
And I'll explain. There was an op-ed piece in the Washington Post a couple of days ago that argued that Americans shouldn't criticize Russia over these anti-gay laws because there are many jurisdictions in the United States that have similar laws. Well, there are major differences. One is the vector of development. You know, this country is very clearly going in very quickly going in the direction of growing acceptance and sort of making the LGBT identity in a way almost irrelevant, you know, by equalizing access to rights and services. So that's one thing, is just how the direction in which things are changing. But the other thing that's even more important is that it's the Kremlin that's behind this campaign of hatred. It's like if the White House had decided to launch a campaign against a particular social group in the United States and devoted all its might to fighting the social group. And in addition, it's as if the White House dominated all the electronic media in the country, and so all the national networks reported directly to the White House, and the White House told them to put homophobic messages on at least once a week. It kind of looks like that. So I think that when you get to the level of argument where you say, well, there's homophobia in the United States as well, of course there is. The problem with Russia is not with homophobia. The problem is with the fact that the Kremlin has unleashed a campaign against this particular minority, inciting violence and directing all its disproportionate might toward destroying this one group of people.
And for you, then, I mean, it's you, others as well. I mean, it's almost as if there was like a campaign of terror or the fear of terror going on throughout Russia, which is one of the parts that drove you out. I mean, this must have been very difficult for you. I mean, talk a bit about what happened. I mean, because you had to make a very difficult decision. You wanted to come back there and live in Russian society to help transform it, to be part of it, to be a journalist, but you had to leave.
It's hard to leave your home.
Yes.
I feel a little bad complaining about that because I've actually had a very soft landing. I mean, I have a U.S. passport. I had the means and the documents necessary to just pick up my family and leave. That's not true of a lot of people who are coming over to this country, planning to seek asylum, who are not going to have any kind of status for at least a year, and possibly for many of them for many years, who have no means to support themselves while they're seeking asylum. And the fact that there are already dozens of people like this who are over in this country that I know of, that I personally know of, means that there's actually a full-fledged refugee crisis from Russia. And, you know, again, as painful as it was to leave my home, and unlike most people, I actually made a conscious decision to make Russia my home over the last 20 years. It didn't just happen to me. But as painful as it was, I'm thinking of the people who don't have the luxury of putting all their stuff in a container and shipping it to the United States and being able to buy a house here.
So, I mean, one of the reasons you left was your children, correct?
That's the only reason I left.
That's the only reason you left?
Yes, was because it was very clear that the authorities would go after my children and would try to take them out of the family.
So I'm curious about the movement that's taking place in Russia now. I mean, the movement for a more democratic Russia, a movement for greater human rights. I mean, how much does that affect the population? I saw the race in Moscow. I didn't cover it that closely, but there seemed to be a candidate who garnered a number of votes who was at least more liberal than others. I'm curious where you see it all now.
I think it's a little bit of an overstatement to even call it a movement.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Vladimir Putin has been in power in Russia for 14 years. In the first year, he completed the process of taking over the media. So we haven't had access, the opposition of any sort has not had access to any media, any national media, in over 12 years. In the first 5 years, Putin completed the process of dismantling the Russian election system. So when you look at the Moscow elections, you have to understand first that it's not a real election, that the ballot is controlled by the authorities, that the election is called at the time that is convenient for the authorities, that the outcome is preordained, that the opposition candidate, even though miraculously he was allowed to run, did not have access to media. So he had to campaign basically only door-to-door and by hanging out banners. And you realize that's a sham election. And that's the most democratic election-resembling thing we've had in a decade.
I mean, so it's very obviously you're not sounding very optimistic about what the immediate future might be for reform in Russia. I'm curious what you think about how you think the world should have responded to the Olympics. This is a great debate: boycott, no boycott, people standing up at the Olympics at least for gay rights, and as happened in some other Olympics for other issues. I mean, what was your take on that?
I spoke out in favor of a political boycott of the Olympics. And I should say that the members of Pussy Riot, who were released at the end of December after serving nearly 2 years in jail, one of the first things they said when they got out of jail was that anybody who goes to Putin's Olympics is condoning his policies. And there are no two ways about it. You cannot separate politics from sport.
Right.
And anybody who says that is being either naive or misleading, and I think the latter is more likely. The Olympics is a grand show of national pride. It is, for Putin especially, it is Putin's personal project. He personally traveled to Guatemala City in 2007 to lobby the International Olympic Committee to give the Games to Russia. It's extremely important for him that people come to Sochi. It's extremely important for him that state leaders come to Sochi. I'm very happy that at the opening ceremonies they didn't have anybody to put to his left. So he was standing there. On his right was Thomas Bach, the head of the International Olympic Committee. And on his left was a woman I couldn't actually identify, who was like wearing a bunch of badges. What he really wanted was to have David Cameron or Barack Obama on his left. That didn't happen, and thank God that didn't happen. And I'm very grateful to all the Western European leaders and to President Obama for not sending highly placed officials to Russia. I can't believe that some Western countries did. I can't believe the Dutch prime minister went there after Russia took hostage a Dutch ship in international waters in September and continues to hold the ship and barely released the 30 people that it held in jails for 2 months.
So what is the state now of gay and lesbian activists and of environmental activists in the midst of these Olympics? Do you know what are there things we don't know in the Western press? They're not being reported.
Well, I don't know. Do you know that on the day of the opening of the Olympics, dozens of people were arrested in Moscow and St. Petersburg
for nonviolently holding up signs?
In St. Petersburg they held up signs. In Moscow they went to Red Square to sing the national anthem, the Russian national anthem. And they were detained. They were taken to a police station. There were about 12 people who were detained there. They were taken to the police station. They were held for 4 hours. Most of them weren't booked, but they were beaten and threatened with rape.
Marcia, I guess I'm sorry we have to take this break here, but I do appreciate you taking the time with us, and I do look forward to your returning to these airwaves and continuing this story. I think it's important for our listeners to hear and to hear your story and the story of others who are standing up, and I deeply appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Then I look forward to maybe having you come back to talk about Words Will Break Cement, the passion of Pussy Riot.
Great.
Let's do that for a longer session.
All right.
Thank you so much. Marcia Gessen. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back with Dee Watkins. Don't go away.
There's a man going down, Lord, taking